A legal education means you will learn to speak in a new language. You will be taught to achieve insight into the world around you and to sharply question what you know.
You can't handle the truth!
What are you doing, detective? What are you doing talking to my client without me present? You sneaky Pete.
Lose! I don't lose! I win! I win! I'm a lawyer! That's my job! That's what I do!
Okay, everybody, welcome to the Comedians at Law podcast. This is episode 64. This is Alex Barnett. I'm joined in the booth by Matt Ritter.
Hey, everybody.
We're really excited to be here with you as we approach the... I guess Christmas holiday and New Year holiday. Even for those of you who aren't Jewish, it's a big who aren't Christian like us. It's still a big time of year, holiday season. We're actually performing at a bunch of holiday parties, right, Matt? So
it's exciting. I like to not get too drunk when I'm performing at these holiday parties.
Yeah, it's always a danger when they're serving good food and good beverages.
Yeah, you don't want to be the guy who's actually literally swimming in the eggnog. Just doing laps.
That's right. But we've got some really exciting things on the rise. As we mentioned, we've got some holiday parties we're performing at this month. And then next month, we're coming out of the chute really quickly. We've got an event we're performing at Vanderbilt Law School. We're performing at Crossroads in New Jersey. And also on the same day, I'll be down in Georgia, Augusta, Georgia, performing for the Augusta Bar. So our January calendar is already filling up. And if you're interested in having us perform for you or for your organization, definitely let us know at info@comediansatlaw or tweet us at comediansatlaw.
Hey, what did you get me for Hanukkah?
What did I get you for Hanukkah? Yeah. I got you that you don't have to edit this podcast today.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, what did I get you then?
Yeah, you edited it last week. That's, I think, what that was.
That's it? That's our gift exchange?
That was the mutual exchange. It was a barter system.
Oh, man, us Jews, we don't do it fun. I'm having a Christmas party tonight. I told you guys last week, we hired carolers. They will be here tonight.
So how is that?
I'm excited. They're going to be dressed up in Dickens costumes. They're called the Jollies, so they better bring some Jollies.
Wow, I can't believe you did that.
Should I see if I can get them to sing one Jewish song, like Hava Nagila or something?
Yeah, get them to sing one Hanukkah or Jewish song and record it, and let's play it on the podcast next week.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to record it, but I don't know if I could just take the recorded
music.
Well,
ask them. Get their permission, certainly, because you are an attorney. You know how to get a release.
Yeah, I'll get a release from them, from the Jollies. You know what? I'm going to get a release to own their music from tonight's show.
You'll be the new manager and agent for the Jollies?
Yeah. So I'm excited about that.
That's cool.
Get the music going.
But we've got a lot of really exciting things on the horizon. So if you haven't already signed up for our mailing list to get some free deals or good deals, please do that. Go to our website, www.comediansatlaw.com, or hit us up on Twitter, as mentioned, and we'll let you know about our upcoming events. Or talk to you about coming to your organization. Matt, well, let's get right into the news because we've got actually a very special segment coming up with the Ladies of Law. So let's not delay. We want to get into the news and then get to the Ladies of Law, okay?
Yeah, I'm good with that. Let's hit the news.
Since when has the paragon of investigative journalism allowed lawyers to determine the news content?
Okay, so this week, the big news story is the one that you unearthed, which was all over the papers. It's about the affluenza defense.
Amazing.
Yeah. For those who don't know, a 16-year-old drunk driver escaped jail time, even though he killed four people last June. And the defense was that he is a child of privilege. Now, bear in mind, he was facing four counts of manslaughter, up to 20 years in jail. But he was sentenced to 10 years of probation. After the defense argued he was a victim of his family's wealth, and the expert called it affluenza.
I'd like to be a victim of his family's wealth.
That's right. I mean, who wouldn't want to be a victim of wealth?
Yeah.
But now there's been an outcry and a backlash about this, about whether or not this is going to start to crop up more and more as a legal defense in various cases where kids from privilege are able to escape responsibility because they suffer from affluenza.
I mean, it's just outrageous. I mean, on what grounds? What does that even mean legally? What does that even mean legally?
Well, we don't know. I mean, it's an evolving body of law. I mean, you can now – maybe all these out-of-work lawyers and law students can now specialize in affluenza law.
Right, but I mean, look, let's break this down, right? Like, if you're going to assert a defense, right, you either did it or you didn't do it or you're pleading insanity. There's no other plea, self-defense. It's not self-defense. It's not insanity. You're guilty or you're innocent.
I guess it's a form of insanity or a subset where you're saying that you're not responsible for your actions because you're a victim of your own surroundings.
Right, but then on the flip side – I'm so poor, I don't give a crap about anything, and then I hit somebody with a car. Aren't I a victim of my own poor fluenza?
Right, poverty fluenza.
Yeah.
Certainly you could argue that. I think it's an interesting – because one of the articles I read said that basically these people are just spoiled brats, and we shouldn't let people off from liability because they're spoiled.
Of course we shouldn't let them off. We should put them – you ever see that movie? I don't know. This is – this probably never really happened in the law, but it was a great movie. Joe Pesci forced to live in his slum? He's a landlord, slumlord.
Yes. Yes, it's a good movie.
I feel like that's a good answer then. If you don't want to put him in jail for 20 years, put him in the hood.
Yeah.
Put this kid in the hood for 20 years.
Right. Well, if you step back, it raises a lot of interesting questions. Because first of all, it's the question of whether or not this is a viable or a ridiculous defense. But the other part is it goes to sentencing generally. In other words, if a 16-year-old gets drunk and drives and either hurts or kills people, is the appropriate sentence to send that person into jail for 20 or 30 years? Or is there a better method of sentencing that would perhaps rehabilitate and this person and make them a more contributory member of society?
Well, you know what? And you bring up an interesting question, because after the knee-jerk reaction, you're right. That is the real question. You know, the knee-jerk is, oh, screw these rich people. But really, we're talking about a 16-year-old kid.
Yeah, and so my thought is, well, wait a second. Okay, I agree with you. Just letting this kid off scot-free or with an easier sentence because he's from rich surroundings is ridiculous. But at the same time, maybe there's a way to get at this in a better way. For example, if his family really does have wealth, maybe a part of the sentence should be an enormous, really punitive fine where the family has to fork over millions of dollars of their wealth, yeah. a really hurtful penalty financially, so that the whole family feels the responsibility of his actions.
I say they all have to work on a chain gang together, the whole family.
Well, but also I agree with you. I think that the parents should be held accountable. I mean, if you're going to say that the defense goes to the parents' behavior in raising the child, then I think, yes, the sentence should reach out to the parents and say, well
– yeah. How about they have to go to jail in his stead then? If that's the defense, right? If you say, well, it's because this other person had such an influence and caused them to have such an egregious – just an egregious attitude towards the law. I'm above the law. Well, whoever created that mentality and that mindset has to be responsible. It's almost like, mind manipulation. It's almost like, hey, this person's under my mind control, and anything they do, they're just the tool.
I think it's that, but I also would almost take a page out of the Seinfeld episode with the butler. I think that the parents of the child who committed the crime should have to go work as domestic servants for the injured – for the victims or the victims' families. So like if you've got a 16-year-old who's a real spoiled brat who's doing drugs and blowing up little animals, you have to go to the victim's family and you have to work as their butler for a year or two or three.
I like that.
Yeah, right? I mean, I think
– I mean, of course they're going to really be – hate. They're going to hate your guts because your son killed their family members.
Right, and they're going to –
it's going to be tricky.
That's right.
It's not going to be a comedy. It's not going to be like The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Exactly right, but I think that's the way to get at this. That's the way to get parents to reform their behavior. Now, I'll be honest. Now, look – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, look, the tension is, as a parent, you recognize that at some point in life, you want your child to have everything they want and to give them everything they want. But you realize that if you do that, they're going to be spoiled and they're going to turn into people who aren't contributing members of society. So there's always a tension. Right. And so I'm sensitive to these parents. But at the same time, you have to man up sometimes and say no.
Yeah. But at the same time, right, speaking on parenting, I wanted to hit on that note. and I'm going to play devil's advocate here. Isn't one of the main reasons that you become wealthy so that you can get your kids out of trouble?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think that's right. I mean, in other words, you get money and you get influence so that at some point in life, when your kid does something stupid, you can buy their way out.
I mean, let's be honest. Isn't that one of the biggest advantages of being wealthy as a parent?
I think you're absolutely right. Well, first of all, I mean, like the Kennedys have thrived on this philosophy.
I mean, they've bought their way out of like multiple sexual assaults and death and homicide.
Right. I mean, Ted Kennedy, you know, rest in peace.
Yeah.
You know, Chappaquiddick is illustration A.
You know, I mean, obviously to our listeners, I'm kind of half joking because I don't have that kind of money anyway. So it's a moot point. But I mean, look, we all know that teenagers will be teenagers, and to a degree, this does not excuse somebody running somebody over. But it's only a matter of luck that a lot of us don't end up in these situations as teens.
And I think anybody who's done anything as a teenager, which is basically 99.9% of the population, has had an episode where you were like, you know, a hair's breadth away from doing something irredeemable. You know, where there's no way to walk it back.
Yeah.
And it's only by the grace of God or just dumb luck that you missed hitting somebody, killing yourself, whatever.
Well, and which is why we have the law, you know, set an age for what an adult is to be, you know, tried for crimes like this.
Right. But there should be, I mean, look, it also doesn't mean that you should have license when you're 16 to just go out and get drunk and drive all over the place.
No.
And kill people, which is what this kid did, regrettably.
He should have to shower in prison for a couple of weeks at least.
Yeah. But getting back to affluenza, I mean, I think obviously on its face, it's a ridiculous concept. And I think there was an interview Anderson Cooper did with the psychologist who testified on behalf of the kid where Cooper savaged the guy because he said, come on, this is absurd. You're basically creating a science around an absurd construct.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we can create an affluenza around any social thing.
Right. I mean, so it's like – because then you think about like, well, oppressed minorities could say, well, I wanted to kill somebody who's, you know, white or rich because they've been holding me down. And it's called, you know, race fluenza. And, you know, it just opens the floodgates to all kinds of nonsense. I think
– comedy fluenza. Comedy has gotten me so beat down that I decided to crash my car into a room full of people.
Well, now, wait a second. That's a legitimate thing.
That's a real one.
That's a real one.
Comedy fluenza.
Because anybody who's performing comedy knows that it's – painful, and you'll never – it just makes you want to do evil, criminal things.
Yeah, so we're above the law now, officially.
Absolutely. Well, let's get a final word on this. I mean, what do you think is going to happen here, Matt? I mean, do we think this is going to have any legs, or this is going to go the way of, like, the Kardashians' marriages?
You know, I can't see any judge worth his salt. But look, there's all these local judges, you know, like we said, that are probably friends with the parents. You know, that'll hear this and they'll factor it in. I mean, it's just an argument for mercy, really.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. All right. Well, look, we have to move on. We've got a very special segment this week involving the ladies of Comedians at Law. So we should get right to that now.
All right.
Well, this week, just to set it up, we had the ladies of the group, Genevieve Goldstein, Ndidi Origi, Joan Weisblatt, and Julie Katakis, get together in a roundtable discussion about an article that appeared in the New York Times some years ago about a number of female lawyers who started at Debevoise, a big law firm that's got offices all over the world, and then followed up with them several years later to see what they were still doing, or whether they were still at the firm, whether they were even still practicing law. And they had a really fabulous discussion, so let's get to that right now.
This is Ndidi, and I'm on with Genevieve and Julie and Joan. It looks like everyone has J names but me. We are the ladies of Comedians at Law. And we just wanted to talk a little bit about an article that was in the New York Times a couple weeks ago. And I wanted you guys to say hi, everyone.
Hey, it's Genevieve.
Hello. Hello.
There you are. So I'll just do a quick summary of it. Basically, it was an article that included a video updating another article that was written in 2001 about 21 women lawyers who started at Debevoise as associates. And it was just basically asking them what they thought their careers would be in 10 years. And then the video and article from this year went back and checked in with them to see who was still at the firm and where they were now in their careers and if their thoughts had changed on sort of being a woman practicing law. So one of the things I found really interesting was that in the original article, they talked about in 1981, the class of 1981, there were 13 women who started. Only two of them were left. In 91, there were only three left from that class. So the ones in 2001, it appeared that there were just a handful left, and I'm assuming they couldn't get a hold of all the women. So I just wanted to ask you all, starting off, you know, if you could relate to any of the women in the video and what you thought about them.
This is Genevieve. I'll jump right in. I definitely related. There was one woman who was talking about, she actually read what she had said in the article, and it was that if she worked hard, she could accomplish anything. And I think it's sad to say, but I think that's totally naive, and yet I felt the exact same way in college and law school. I really thought if you worked hard, you could do anything you wanted to. And working hard doesn't necessarily get you everywhere. Sometimes it's connections, sometimes it's sheer luck. And I think growing up, you just have to realize that, and that also adjust your definitions of success. Otherwise, you're always going to feel a little bit frustrated or inadequate.
Yeah, it's a really good point.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's a really good point about sort of coming in with that naive notion and then facing the reality of what actually are the obstacles that women face in the law. But go ahead, Joan.
I had a very different experience from any of these women. I was at the same firm for 30 years, and it was a much smaller firm, granted, and it was in New Jersey. But when I started, I knew that I wanted to have a family and felt that I would be able to do it all, and I was actually able to do it all because my firm was incredibly accommodating to me. So that may be very different from what these women experienced because of possibly a lack of flexibility on the part of the partnership at that particular firm.
Do you all think that there's something inherently sort of limiting about the structure of the law firm today and the way it's been for years about sort of how you succeed in a law firm? Or do you all think that, you know, the system as it is fine?
This is John V again. I have a lot to say. I think that most law firms are set up like pyramid schemes. In a way, they're just like multi-level marketing. And if you're a partner that got in a long time ago, you're making a ton of money on everyone else billing for you. And I think as the economy has tanked and slowly recovered, and just as the legal industry has changed with outsourcing and very few firms being able to charge the sort of billing rates they used to, that it's harder and harder, and firms are less willing to create more partners and more equity partners. And I also think a lot of people go into firms these days saying, I'm going to do 1 to 3 years, I'm going to pay off some loans, get some experience, and then I'm going to go government or small firm private. And so even the intent to go on the partnership track, I think, has dwindled as the opportunities for partnership has dwindled.
Well, this is something I wanted to hear what you all thought about, because I feel like at some point all of these articles, you know, various articles about women succeeding in the professional world are all based on the assumption that it's a good thing to make partner, it's a good thing to get to these highest levels. And, Genevieve, you mentioned earlier about sort of defining your own success. And I wanted to ask, do you all think that there's something to be said for sort of teaching not just women, but all law students that are coming through about that particular part of it, that you really need to kind of define what you think success is going to be before you get into those situations? I don't know if Joan, you wanted to talk about that, since you were saying that you kind of knew when you were coming in what success would look like for you.
Right. You know, it's very hard for me to compare the type of law firm situation that you're talking about, because I was able to work through what my expectations were with the firm and had them accommodate me, I guess because I was a valuable employee to them. But you have to keep in mind that the firm was much smaller. So, for example, when it was time for me to become partner, and this is in the 1980s, so it's obviously a different time, I was pregnant and said that I wanted to work on a part-time basis as a partner, and they allowed that. And I'm not sure that that's something that firms either, you know, big firms in New York, for example, would have sanctioned 20 years ago or today. Maybe you can speak to that. I really don't know.
Yeah, in my experience, with my big law firm experience, I knew there were a handful of women who were on sort of a part-time schedule before they made partner and continued on that when they became partner. But I knew that many of those women were on a sort of part-time track for a very long time because it just took much longer in order for them to become partner. And it wasn't looked at as a – it was looked at more as an exception rather than the rule. So I still think that even the firms, the big firms in New York who have that option, it's not necessarily something that everyone, the women or the men, feel like is a real option that's on the table, because it's always just a handful of people who are doing it. There was one thing that I found – oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was going to ask, but do you find that now – when these women do make partner, that the firms, that the partners, that their fellow partners, so to speak, are flexible about, for example, working at home and telecommuting, or, you know, maybe coming in a few days a week and then doing the rest of the work at home, or, you know, being flexible. Is that something that fits in these days with having a partner who, you know, finally, someone finally made it to partner after having been pregnant and had a family?
Well, it's interesting because I feel that the it's so firm specific, and that's part of the issue. Depending on where you land, you have a totally different experience. So you're talking about your experience at a smaller firm. Even in the larger firms, I know that there are differences with how that works. So in some places, a woman who is part-time and becomes a partner and continues to be part-time is sometimes seen as a rock star because, hey, she was able to do and accomplish all this even on a part-time schedule. And in other places, that partner is known not to have as much power and not being able to sort of control her work in the same way that someone who was not part-time is. So it's so firm dependent, and I think that's part of the issue, is that it's not really something that's become ingrained in legal culture. It just depends on, you know, where you land. But you did bring up a good point, Joan, and I wanted to maybe get Julie's thoughts on the role of technology, you know, in providing this flexibility. Because one of the things I thought was very funny in the original article in 2001 was that the author said, you know, we asked these women to scroll forward on their Palm Pilots to see what things would look like in 10 years. And I thought that was really funny, but it brought up the thought for me of sort of what role, you know, technology has advanced so much since 2001, just since a decade ago. And what role, if any, do you feel like technology plays, Julie, in providing that flexibility?
Well, for me, it's having the opportunity to work from home, and that's, you know, hand in hand with technology, it makes it a lot easier for me. I'm a mom, and I'm what I call an alone mom. It's just, there's just one parent, that's me. So I don't have a lot of flexibility as far as being a parent. But for example, I'm going to start working from home very soon. And what's valuable about that, obviously, as an alone parent, is that, you know, my daughter's sick or I have to pick her up, I can actually do that now. So having that there, I think, could make all the difference as far as parents, and I don't want to just say women parents, progressing in legal fields or any field, or particularly any field that's male-dominated. But, you know, when I was reading through the article, one of the women mentioned that she's a family and maybe a son, I think it was, and how she couldn't do it without her husband. And I kind of cringe a little bit because I don't really have that. And I feel like I'm still capable of doing whatever it is that I want to do. And although it's sort of naive to say if you work hard, you do get what you want, I think it's a matter of adjusting, not necessarily the end result of success, but how long maybe it will take you to get there and how you'll get there. It takes a lot more creativity. This word, so technology is a creative way for me to get to my end result, which I don't plan on changing.
And you make a really good point about the article. I did notice that as well. A few of the women sort of talked about the role of their partner. And it called to mind the article that was in the New York Times just this past weekend about women succeeding on Wall Street because they have stay-at-home husbands, which I thought was so funny because it didn't really show a lot of progress in my mind because it still required one person to kind of not have their career aspirations, which, you know, hey, if they didn't have them, then that's great. But some of these women had husbands who also had professional careers, but they needed to make a decision as to saying, okay, well, she can pull in $1 million on Wall Street or whatever it is, and it makes more sense for me to stay home with the children. And it seemed like those men who were stay-at-home dads would still face some of the same issues that, you know, stay-at-home moms used to face in the past. One other question I had for you guys before we wrap things up is, you know, I was wondering whether you all are sort of tired of having this conversation because it seems like there's always an article, there's always some other thing bubbling up in the culture, sort of about, you know, women and work and life and balancing. And do you think it's an important conversation to keep having?
Go ahead, Joan.
Okay. I think it's a very important conversation to keep having. And the reason that we keep having it is because we haven't found a solution to it. And I think that, you know, ingrained in our culture, and I don't think it's completely gone, is when women do need some flexibility because of children, that men at the firm do sometimes get resentful about it. And until women find that they're on an equal footing, even if they do have responsibilities at home, we're going to keep having this conversation.
May I chime in for a moment?
Sure.
I think that Joan is right in that it's a perception and a cultural sort of idea that we have, but I don't think it's just anti-women in the workforce. I think it's also anti-man in the family model. So, you know, just when you look at statistics, which is always what is put out there, oh, the women that started are no longer there, there's very few. I think there's more choice for women, less pressure on women to stay as the one that's working and the man to stay at home. That's what I see to be a problem. I haven't worked in a large firm, so I don't know exactly what that is like. I know that in the world of comedy, it's very male-dominated, and there are definitely some hurdles that one has to go through. But it's sort of just expected, like, oh, well, you're the woman, so you'll stay at home, or you're the man, so you'll go to work. So I think it's just more of a perception for both men and women as to where their roles are and what's acceptable for men to do and women to do.
And this is Genevieve. I think Julie brought up an excellent point that this isn't just in the legal industry. I mean, as comedians, we all face the idea that when we're introduced on a show, here's the one person, you know, who has lady parts. And you know, when I say I work in the legal industry, I would say at least 70% of the time, the guy says, oh, you're a secretary. So I think we do need to have this discussion. At the same time, I think there's a divide amongst women themselves. I am a woman without any children, and I will fully admit sometimes I get annoyed when a woman with a child gets to go home at 3 and I have to stay till 10. And so I think that there's also some tension among women and what the role of a successful woman is, and that it is important we keep discussing so that we get all those viewpoints out there and one day reach an area where maybe we're not talking about women and men, we're just talking about quality of life in general.
You all made some really great points. I think, Genevieve, that your what you just said sort of hit on something for me that I wanted to bring up, which was, you know, one of the things that I have noticed that continues to not change as a Black person, as well as a woman, is that I remember when I was at the firm, we had a lot of stories, other Black female and male associates, about sort of being mistaken for either the delivery person or the mail person or paralegal or any other type of support staff rather than a lawyer. And I know one of the folks in the original 2001 article brought this up. And I know from sort of talking to friends who are still at law firms that that just doesn't seem to change. And I think sometimes the conversation gets, on my part, it gets a little tiring because I feel like, well, this is 2013. At some point, you're going to have to start realizing that there are women who are comedians and there are, you know, Black people who are lawyers and, you know, not necessarily assuming that everyone needs to fit into your preconceived notions of what people can and can't do. So last thing, just to wrap this up, I wanted to know if you all could just kind of give your thoughts for some of our younger listeners. If you are a woman who was graduating from law school this year, let's say, what to sort of do so that in 10 years you'll be wherever it is that you want to be. And what, maybe we'll go Joan, Julie, and Genevieve.
Well, I would suggest that because times are a little bit different, I think it's a good idea to figure out what your expectations are and what you're looking for in your life, and try, I guess, to be a little bit more realistic about what you as a person, as an individual, want to achieve so that you don't end up possibly disappointed in yourself that you were not able to be Superwoman. That's my perspective.
And Genevieve?
Go ahead, Julie.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Julie. Go ahead.
I thought you said me.
I did.
I knew it. Yeah, I was going to say, as a young person, I'm going to assume these are young people that we're talking about, but it doesn't necessarily have to be, of course, but the struggle I always had as a younger person was figuring out what it is that I really wanted to do and not what I was supposed to do, which is kind of talking about earlier, you know, being partner, is that your definition of success? You know, whatever makes you tick is what you want to gravitate towards. So, because that's what's going to make you find your all. You know, you can have it all. Your all changes as life changes. Kids come into the picture. It's not about giving things up. It's about, oh, my all has changed, and that's okay, and you want to put more energy into other things. So being open to flexibility and creativity are probably the most important things, not just to achieve success, your own success as it changes through life. And today, because it is more challenging as far as being a lawyer and just careers in general, but again, just being flexible with how you get there and creative about how you get there.
Great. And Genevieve?
I would say be open-minded. I think a lot of law students, and certainly me, were very type A, were very focused. I knew exactly what I wanted, what kind of law I wanted to practice, what kind of firm I wanted to go to. And when I got those things, I was absolutely miserable because I had never considered any other option would be good for me. So I think try out different types of law. I went into transactional entertainment law, and now I do criminal litigation. And so really just be open and don't be worried about prestige. I was always so concerned with my diplomas and if my job sounded impressive to people. And I think part of that was being a woman and wanting that level of respect. But really, the respect you should be looking for is that respect from yourself and the people who really care about you rather than just the world in general.
And I would just add that you should try to succeed on your own terms and know what it is that you want to get. If you are going to go to a big law firm, know what you want to get out of that firm and get it, whether it be experiences, connections, all of that. Take advantage of what they learned at the firm and also the connections they made at the firm. So if you are focused on sort of getting into a big law firm, know what you want to get out of it and don't just go there because, you know, that's what you've heard is what you need to do to succeed. Thank you, ladies. We're going to turn it back to Alex.
Okay. Well, that was enlightening. Certainly not anything that either one of us has any knowledge about.
No, I didn't know any of that stuff.
And our final segment before we get to the Twitter feed is, of course, our usual weekly segment starring our own Kevin Israel, entitled Kevin versus the Internet.
Thanks, Matt and Alex. This is Kevin Israel with another installment of Kevin versus the Internet. I like to use a segment to discuss a story online that's really been driving me crazy, and this week I definitely have a good one. If you're living on the East Coast, probably getting some cold weather, and the cold weather usually leads to people getting sick. It becomes flu season, so influenza is all over the place, but we're not talking about influenza today. Today we're going to be talking about affluenza. Affluenza is a buzz term created by some media heads. It describes a situation or a condition that stems from a child having wealthy or privileged parents who never sets limits, so they don't understand any consequences for their actions. This all stems from a Texas case earlier this June. A teen named Ethan Couch claims that affluenza was to blame for his drunken driving accident that led to the death of four people. The resultant issue here was that Judge Jean Boyd sentenced the teen to 10 years of probation but no jail time. She says she's working to find a long-term treatment facility. Needless to say, the families and loved ones of those who were lost in the accident are extremely upset with this and say that this is sending a bad message, and that just because you have money, you shouldn't be able to use that as a defense. And I think this is ridiculous. Listen, this is just about spoiled kids doing stupid shit. We shouldn't start putting words to it and making legal defenses out of it. We're looking for psychological babble to explain why a kid doesn't understand that if you get into a car hammered and start driving, that you could end up killing yourself and, worse, other people. This is a disgusting display of what happens to our society as we like to overdiagnose and overtreat and put medical terms to everything. This is just bad parenting. I guess what's good out of this is that maybe parents will start thinking about how they parent and the long-term consequences of just giving their kids everything. I think kids today are way too spoiled, and they don't understand that their actions do have consequences, and they can't think, you know, two steps ahead of themselves. They're so lost in the now and the living for what's fun and what's immediate that they don't realize that, you know, there is tomorrow and the next day, and what they're doing could affect people. And it just disgusts me. This Ethan Couch is just a spoiled little brat who should have gotten really the book thrown at him, because it's disgusting and it's horrible that four people died because of his irresponsibility, and that now parents are saying, oh, you know, it was our fault. We didn't parent him well. Well, yeah, you didn't, but that shouldn't be a defense in court, and that shouldn't be a condition that comes recognized because your kid does something stupid and you need to find an out for him. It's just – it's really disgusting, and I think it's emblematic of a bigger problem in our society with people just looking for excuses for everything instead of just saying, I screwed up and now I've got to pay the price. And that's really what this comes down to. The kid did something stupid. He got drunk, and now he should have to pay the price. But he's got 10 years probation, and four people are dead. So that's very nice. I hope the judge is happy with his extremely, extremely weak-wristed decision here. My heart goes out to the families, and this Ethan Couch, you know, he's a bad example of what's going on, and I think this is just terrible. I knew a lot of spoiled kids growing up, and I don't think that was a defense for their stupid actions. Their stupid actions were just that, stupid. So this is a disgusting one. If you've got any thoughts on affluenza, if you've known any kids who suffered from affluenza, tweet at me at KevinIsrael_NJ. I'd love to hear some stories about the spoiled, privileged few who apparently get away with everything, and now they actually have a term for it, which is just disgusting. I've got a term for it. It's just being a friggin' dope. So anyway, that's it for me, Kevin Israel. This was Kevin versus the Internet, and now back to you, Alex and Matt.
Well, now, Matt, we're going to turn to the Twitter feed, and let's see what we got going on this week in Twitter. Well, as always, I'll say one thing for our fans. They're consistent. They keep following us.
They do. We're building followers. That's for sure.
We have a lot of new followers. I mean, if you just look at the Twitter feed in the last week, we've gotten, I don't know how many, but people don't write to us. I mean,
there's no love for us.
Right. It's fascinating. I'm just looking at,
Well, maybe we should start, you know, reaching out to all of our new followers and saying, hey, thanks for joining our club, you know?
Yeah. Oh, actually, you know what? I spoke too soon. We have Mr. Bernard, who's been a follower of the podcast for, I think, since the beginning, at Adjective Maker. And he's got a question to us that we answered. He's got some criticisms for us about the podcast, which are well placed.
What did he say?
Well, let's see. He said he wants us. First of all, he wants us to do stories on FMLA law because he's an HR person.
Okay.
Then he says he would like. We need to standardize the podcast, though, and he puts in parens style, content, audio, timing, which is a fair criticism. Although we thought we were working on that, but all right, we'll do better. And then he gives us his take on grounds for disbarment as a lawyer. Interesting. Well, all right. So I take back my comment. We actually have one fan who is engaging with us very, very vigorously.
I like that.
Yeah. But otherwise,
we got, who do we have? We have Ivan Sayahasan following us. We got this is a cool one. Law.com followed us.
Yeah, I mean we've got a lot of really good followers.
Law.com, does it get any bigger than that?
No, it's the whole law. The law.
That's everything. That's the whole universe of law.
Right.
We have legal vanity numbers. We've got small town Minnesota. We've got number two hukumsip.com. I don't know what that is, but that's somebody. And who else?
I think that's it. Yeah. But I mean, the point is people are following us, which is great. Now, what we're asking you to do is to reach out and do more than just follow us. We want you to engage with us. So, you know, tweet us, email us, tell us what you want to hear. Tell us what you don't like or what you like about the podcast. Tell us if you'd like us to come to your town or community to perform or perform for your bar group or law firm or law school. Matt and Johnavi and Adam Bloom, who remember the group, are all in Los Angeles. If you are on the West Coast and you want to have a show out there, let us know. We can service that need. If you're on the East Coast, we've got plenty of people out here. If you're in the middle of the country, you know, we'll get on a plane.
We'll get there. We'll figure it out.
But in any event, let's give people something to tweet at us next week, Matt. Let's give them a challenge. Either something about affluenza, I think. Or maybe about ladies in the law. I think that was a compelling segment. Let's get the ladies out there writing to us.
How about somebody tell us something only women lawyers have to deal with, something funny.
Oh, I love that. That's great. That's great.
So this is for our women lawyers out there. Something funny that only women lawyers have to deal with. Tweet us that for a chance to win a free T-shirt.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. Well, that's podcast episode 64. I'm Alex Barnett.
And I'm Matt Ritter.
And we will see you guys next week.
All right.